Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number 5, we have Reuters' scandalous report alleging that members of the Saudi monarchy are conspiring against Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The outlet cited unnamed sources that supposedly revealed a plot to replace MBS with his uncle Prince Ahmed, emphasizing that the king's will doesn't necessarily have to be respected after his retirement or passing if the so-called Allegiance Council doesn't approve of his successor. The storyline presented in the text is that MBS's controversial anti-corruption campaign last November and his progressively modernizing socioeconomic policies have, to quote, destroyed the institutional pillars of nearly a century of Al Saud rule, the family, the clerics, the tribes, and the merchant families, end quote, which is why so many influential figures inside the country apparently want to see him deposed. Reuters quoted an unattributed Saudi source as saying that Prince Ahmed would have the backing of the security apparatus and Western powers if he replaced MBS. But while it's obvious that many European countries and part of the US's deep state would probably back this regime change scenario, there are serious doubts about whether the kingdom's military and intelligence services would also support it. After all, they were integral to the success of MBS's anti-corruption sweep, since without their loyalty, the entire operation would have fallen apart, and many of the high-profile targets could have been tipped off well in advance. The reason why this didn't happen, however, is because these pivotal forces understand that MBS's ambitious Vision 2030 socioeconomic reform strategy is the only realistic possibility of preventing the majority youthful kingdom's impending collapse in a post-oil future. Hence, why they went along with what critics have decried as the so-called deep state coup in order to facilitate the successful implementation of this plan. Although Reuters claims that Prince Ahmed will continue MBS's policy trajectory, this can't by any means be assured because the Crown Prince's multipolar outreaches to Russia and China and his Vision 2030 agenda are the very reasons why some of the Saudi elite and their Western allies want to replace him in the first place. The outlet even specifically mentioned that his country's planned purchase of Russia's S-400 anti-air defense systems has rankled some U.S. officials, which could in turn provide them with a strategic reason to engineer his downfall after manipulating the outcome of the Khashoggi case that the CIA suspiciously blames on MBS himself. With the benefit of hindsight in light of this scandalous report's publication, one would do well to wonder whether the dissident journalist's killing was meant to set MBS up for regime change. The next one up is the joint Russian-Indian-Indra 2018 military drills taking place in South Asia. These two decades-long partners are experiencing a renaissance in their relations after President Putin's landmark visit to the subcontinent early last month thawed the chill that has set over their affairs following India's unprecedented military strategic outreaches to the U.S. in recent years. New Delhi has always maintained that it's pursuing a policy of so-called multi-alignment in balancing between the world's great powers, and while some of its moves can be described as clumsy and therefore prompting a few observers to question its overall intentions, India nevertheless proved that it's interested in maintaining its strategic relations with Russia after committing to purchase the S-400 anti-air defense systems despite the U.S.'s CATSA sanctions threats. As for Russia, it's also practicing multi-alignment through what can be described as its military diplomacy via arms exports and joint drills. Not only is Moscow cooperating with New Delhi in these dimensions, but it's also doing the same with its rivals in Beijing and even Islamabad, albeit to different extents in each. Similarly to how India's military strategic relations with the U.S. aren't aimed against Russia, neither are Russia's ones with China and Pakistan aimed against India either. Rather, it can be argued that Moscow's version of multi-alignment is even more regionally stabilizing than New Delhi's, because Russia endeavors to retain the balance of power between all of its partners, while the U.S. strives to upset it in favor of its new Indian ally to China and Pakistan's mutual detriment. That said, Russian-Indian military ties take on an even more important role than ever before, because Moscow is now the only great power that has any chance whatsoever of exercising moderating influence on New Delhi to counteract Washington's growing sway. To India's credit, its leadership understands the need to remain close to Russia, even if it's progressively diversifying its erstwhile dependency on Moscow's military-industrial complex in favor of its new partners in the U.S., Israel, and France. This aforementioned trend is one of the reasons why the U.S. declined to sanction India for its S-400 deal with Russia, but it'll still take a few decades for it to develop to the point where it seriously threatens Indian-Russian relations. By that point, ties between the two might have also diversified, though away from their military and nuclear energy bases and towards more comprehensive commercial and infrastructure cooperation. Third in our countdown, we have the Austrian foreign minister lambasting the EU for its supposedly too strict policy towards Israel. Karin Knesel also said that her country would take the lead to inject realism into the bloc's ties with Tel Aviv, arguing that Israel is often held to a higher standard than other countries. The diplomat has personal and political reasons for positioning herself as Israel's champion in the EU. The first concerns her desire for Israel to remove its boycott of her for her affiliation with the ruling Freedom Party that's been accused of anti-Semitism because of its Nazi roots, while the second relates to Vienna's vision of becoming a separate pole of influence in an increasingly fractured post-Brexit EU. Particularly in the Central and Eastern European 3C space that comprises part of its former imperial domain. Geopolitical analyst Adam Gary drew important attention earlier this year to how Israel is courting the countries of this region, while Iran's doing the same with the rest of Europe, which continues a trend that's been ongoing for some time. The Western European states have much more influence in the EU than the other ones do, which is why their public stance towards Israel has hitherto become the bloc's. These countries are desperately trying to save the Iranian nuclear deal and occasionally criticize Israel for its illegal settlements in the West Bank, while the Central and Eastern European ones are usually quiet about these issues. Accordingly, Austria saw an opportunity to become Israel's main lobbyist in the continent. Despite priding itself on being a supposedly neutral country along the likes of Switzerland, Austria is gambling that its pro-Israeli pivot could lead to the tiny country punching well above its diplomatic weight in European affairs. If it's successful in getting the bloc to curtail its criticism of the Jewish state and distance itself from the BDS groups that Tel Aviv accuses it of funding. In parallel with this, it's also notable that the Austrian chancellor met with Soros over the weekend to discuss relocating the Color Revolution financier's Central European University from his native Budapest to Vienna, which carries with it the optics of providing refuge for the billionaire's pet project that he claims is being targeted for anti-Semitic reasons. Last but certainly not least, Austria currently holds the EU's rotating six-month presidency until the end of the year, meaning that Vienna veritably has agenda-setting powers that could therefore place the bloc on the course of developing a more pro-Israeli policy by 2019 that would dovetail with the U.S.'s own. Like with all policy pivots, however, this might be a lot easier said than done, and could certainly come up against a lot of resistance from the EU's Western European leaders, thereby widening the bloc's east-west divisions even more in the process. Regardless of how everything plays out, there is an unmistakable irony in the fact that the country responsible for Adolf Hitler is now trying to be Israel's top European ally. Our runner-up is the Mexico First anti-migrant protest taking place in the border town of Tijuana. The very fact that this is happening at all dispels the liberal globalist mainstream media smear attacks that everyone opposed to illegal migration is a racist, fascist, and/or white supremacist. And it also debunks the actually racist notion that Mexican society is politically homogenous. Like in any country, there's a diversity of opinions about everything in Mexico, and especially the topic of illegal migration, whether it concerns their own countrymen or those from the Central American states. In this case, the citizens of Tijuana are concerned the large-scale influx of Central American migrants will lead to socioeconomic and security pressures on their city, similar to those described at length by Ivy League researcher Kelly M. Greenhill in her 2010 book about weapons of mass migration. There is nothing discriminatory in worrying about a host population's ability to absorb an unexpected increase in migrants, and if anything, Tijuana citizens have plenty of reasons to be uneasy about this. Their city had previously functioned as a transit location for migrants en route to the U.S., but might actually become the final destination for them if they're unable to make it across after Trump's increased border security measures, which could even take the form of him temporarily closing the legal border under emergency conditions and dealing a critical blow to the local economy in the process. It's understandable why Mexican citizens don't want to bear these consequences on behalf of Central American migrants, ergo the reason why they're protesting against them. It just so happens that all of this is occurring just before President-elect AMLO takes office at the beginning of December, possibly becoming his leftist administration's first crisis if the protests don't die down before then, which they probably won't unless the migrants either make it across the border or retreat from Tijuana. Mexico's next leader might therefore find himself trapped in the dilemma of having to use force against either the protesters or the migrants, both of which could carry with them serious political ramifications. Siding with the protesters might alienate his leftist base that swept him into the presidency, while going with the migrants could generate an intense nationalist reaction against him and also provoke Trump's wrath. Most observers may not have foreseen it, but the migrant caravan might become more of a problem for the Mexican president than the American one. At our top spot, we've got the Beijing municipal government's recently unveiled plan to implement China's controversial social credit system by 2020. Reuters cited Xinhua as reporting that the capital city will pioneer this interconnected social engineering and law enforcement program. For those who haven't been following it, China wants to roll out a nationwide video surveillance system that links to its already active digital one in order to allocate so-called personal trustworthiness points to every citizen and company, which would incentivize them with privileges for proper behavior while penalizing them for violating socio-legal standards. The social credit system has allegedly been tested in Xinjiang as part of the central government's anti-terror strategy there, and elements of it are reportedly being exported to Venezuela, according to a different Reuters piece released over the weekend. Western voices have criticized the program for bringing to life George Orwell's dystopian 1984 surveillance state, warning that the Chinese's personal freedom will be at risk, as will those of any country's citizens that Beijing exports this technology to. That, however, ignores the fact that there are many different societal models in the world that don't organize themselves around the Western one, such as China's. As an admittedly oversimplistic contrast, China places the state over the citizenry and the collective over the individual, while the West, whether sincerely or not, purports that it practices the opposite model by placing the citizenry over the state and the individual over the collective. The game changer, however, is that China's social credit system will introduce so-called algorithmic governance that sees complex AI programs replacing human decision makers when it comes to enforcing the country's socio-legal standards. This necessitates that the government eventually obtains full video and digital control over every aspect of the country and integrates these two systems into a holistic one that also doles out the privileges and penalties associated with citizen and company behavior in real time. Accordingly, this massive endeavor also required gargantuan amounts of electricity to power the computer processors responsible for running the system and retaining all of its data, meaning that it's probably still many years away from nationwide implementation. Even so, considering that Beijing will soon be pioneering this project in its publicly unveiled form, a few important points deserve to be pondered. It's unclear at this moment whether subjects will be allowed to freely access their social credit file and appeal what they may claim to be unfair penalties inflicted upon them, which also brings into question exactly how long video and digital data will be saved. Another issue is whether the state will selectively release people's information into the public domain in order to shame them and reinforce society's overall adherence to the system standards. Depending on what's publicly disclosed, this could have serious psychological consequences for the alleged violator. On top of that, nobody knows how the algorithm works and whether certain socio-legal infractions can be expunged after some time and or through various rehabilitation programs, meaning that there's the possibility that youthful, non-criminal recklessness and irresponsibility could end up ruining someone's life. Relatedly, the social credit system scoring is decontextualized from a subject's lives, so a violator's abusive relationship, for example, wouldn't be factored into softening any punishment meted out to them if their socio-legal infringement was somehow influenced by it, such as if a woman slapped her verbally abusive partner in public. This could prove to be troublesome in countless cases, but it remains incumbent on the Chinese themselves to work out any possible solutions to it. Lastly, it's unknown whether the social credit system will be applied to government and military officials, or whether there'll be a class among themselves whose actions are judged by human beings and not AI. The argument can be made that their inclusion in the system could be abused for political purposes if a human overseer or watchman is corrupt, but it could also hold them accountable for any crimes that they commit and therefore increase the public's trust in the Communist Party. It'll remain to be seen whether these questions and the many more surrounding China's social credit system are answered in the coming future, but what's known for sure is that the world's largest country is entering an unprecedented era of algorithmic governance. Alright folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning in to my program. Hope you all have a nice rest of your week, and tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.